Hey everybody, what's up? Chad Wesley Smith here for another episode of Beers with Chad. Today I am joined by UFC fighter Danny the Puma Silva, 9-1 in his professional MMA career, 1-0 in the UFC, made his debut a couple weeks ago. I've been lucky enough to be able to serve as Danny's strength and conditioning coach for a few months now, as part of the Bloodline group with Cub Swanson. And we talked to Danny about his upbringing, just down the road here in Santa Ana, California, how the city of Santa Ana has influenced him as his big brothers, being wrestlers and getting into jiu-jitsu, and how that shaped his early combat sports career, leading to him meeting Cub Swanson, going through his amateur career, and now as a professional fighter coming through the LFA into Dana White Contender Series, and finally making his UFC debut. So Danny's definitely an up-and-coming fighter who, you should be excited about, and I think you're going to be a fan of after this. As always, Beers with Chad is brought to you by the Juggernaut AI app. You can use code BEERS to save on your subscription to get fully customized powerlifting strength training that adapts to your feedback and continues to grow and change with you based on your goals as you get stronger. If you're more stressed, less stressed, have not quite as much time to train and need to dial things back, it can make all those changes for you and keep helping you progress. So you visit juggernautai.app and use code BEERS for that. Hopefully you enjoy the episode. Cheers.
Welcome to Beers with Chad.
All right, so first score, Silva. Second score, Koulibal. Mm-hmm. You're standing there waiting for Bruce Buffer to announce the third score, to announce the winner. What's going through your mind?
It's funny because during my camp, like 3 weeks out, I had a dream that I lost a split decision. Mm-hmm. So when they announce his name, the second card, I flipped out. I was like, I lost. I literally said that in my head. I was like, I lost. And I just put my head down and I was like, man, I can't believe my dream came true. This is crazy. And then they said my name and I was like, oh, I lift up my head and I'm like, yeah, I got a big old smile on my face. And I'm like, oh, I guess the dream wasn't true. But yeah, I was freaking out so much in that moment. I was like, man, so disappointed. I'm like, I thought I won.
That had to be a very, very stressful moment like that. Yeah, I know from track meets and powerlifting meets and strongman contests and stuff, like I've had that same thing where I feel like I've dreamed out every possible scenario. Yeah. From like best day of my life, for me in track, like throw a PR, throw a record, mm-hmm. whatever, all the way down to like foul out. Yeah. And then also felt like I've had all of them about to come true. this is my worst nightmare coming true right now. How are you feeling now? What, 3 weeks, a month post first fight?
It's been hard for me to get back into training, just because I've been cornering a lot of my teammates and traveling. The week after, I went to Boston, and then the week after that, I went to go corner Dan. So it was just very, very exhausting for me to really get back into training and really enjoy the win. But it's just, I feel like I've been all over the place and I just need to settle down and be like, all right, I'm back home. I need to focus on myself again. Mm.
So I know your brothers been a really big influence on you and your career. What was their kind of background in combat sports?
We all grew up boxing from my uncles, but they started wrestling in middle school. So by the time when I was 8, they started really, really pushing it on to me, like, hey, you need to start wrestling. And I was always against it just because I wanted a box. But yeah, they started with wrestling and they eventually moved on to jiu-jitsu and they competed. But they just kind of kept it like that. And it was more of a mental push that they always had on me since I was a little kid.
And how much older are they than you?
They're 15 years older than me.
15 years older. Okay. Yeah,
both of them.
That's a big difference. I got two older brothers, nine and 12 years older than I am. And, you know, when I'm 6 years old or something, my 18-year-old brother, like, yes, I would wrestle him, but little kid wrestling is big brother, where your brother's like nice to you in that wrestling, or like kind of
I was definitely raised more military style. They used to bring one of my cousins, and my brother would make sure that I've been training and working out so I could fight him, and then I would lose all the time, so he would whoop me and make sure that I was doing all the push-ups that he thought I could do. So at the time, he thought I could do 40, and I could only do maybe like 25. And he would get so mad. He's like, you need to be able to do 40. And I'd be like, bro, I can't, you know. And he would just whoop me, and then I would be like crying, trying to do them. And then he would make me spar with him. And he would give me enough where I thought I would hurt him, and then he would humble me.
Mm-hmm.
So one time I punched him, and I busted his lip, and he acted like he was hurt, and then I just started like swinging at him. I thought, I was like, oh man, for all the times that he's hit me and all the things that he's done to me, I'm gonna knock him out right now. And then he just hit me right in the middle of the stomach and took out my air, and I was literally on the ground like trying to gasp for air, and he just, get up, like that, like stone cold. And I'm like, you know, I'm dying right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just that type of mentality that he wanted me to kind of get past that fear of whatever, what's the worst that could happen, and keep going after that. But
and they were pretty outstanding wrestlers in high school.
Yeah, both were, but my older brother was the one that excelled the most. He was ranked second in the state and 15 in the nation. Wasn't able to play second or 15, but he was a really decorated wrestler, really good. He used to be trained by Joe Gonzalez, which was a world champion. And yeah, he used to kind of put it on him. When I remember as a kid, he would really out wrestle a world champion, and I was just like, damn, this guy is really, really good. I wanted to be like him, but I wasn't as good as a wrestler as he was.
Did they have aspirations to fight MMA as well, or?
Yeah, so they graduated with Gilbert Melendez. So okay. Gilbert Melendez used to come to our house, and I mean, they used to box with Gilbert, and at that time they used to be able to beat Gilbert in boxing. But they thought that they were going to be the UFC fighters eventually, but they never. They just had too much struggle with my mom being a single mother, and that they just rather go to work. So to help out and kind of be able to live here in Orange County.
So you started out boxing, then they get you into wrestling. Talk to me about the transition, you know, as you developed through those and then wanting to get into MMA.
Well, when I got into wrestling, I hated it for so long, and I didn't really get to appreciate it until I was a junior in high school. So it literally took almost for the ending of my career of wrestling for me to really turn the corner of how good I could have been, and then really appreciated it. And after that, I kind of felt like I still had an itch. So I went into jiu-jitsu right after graduating, and I met Kami, which was Cubs manager at the time at Tomaselli's Academy. And yeah, they introduced me to Marco and Cub, and my MMA career kind of started from there. I wasn't trying to be a fighter. I was just trying to compete and kind of keep that itch kind of going.
And how old were you then?
I was 18 or 19. Yeah.
So how, you know, with Cub, how has your relationship kind of developed with Cub and the influence that he's had on your career?
Well, since I met him, I wasn't a big fan of like UFC particularly, because I was Bellator and UFC were like the only thing I knew. But I didn't know a lot of people in the UFC, and I wasn't really keeping up with it. So when I met Cub, I didn't even know he was in the UFC, which I You know, I felt dumb. I didn't know who Marco was.
That's Marco Juarez.
Yeah, Marco Juarez, King of the Streets. So I was really like ignorant on the sport. So that's why, because I didn't really want to do it. But when I realized that I was getting better, Cub was really the guy that to kind of guide me. Like, hey, you kind of have to pay your dues, but if you keep at it, you're going to be really good. So he really influenced me a lot to have a certain type of style, which I have now.
I didn't realize that you guys had known each other that long. That's like 8 years.
Yeah.
So tell me about sort of the dynamic now you have with the guys at Bloodline and like how your coaching and training is set up.
Yeah, with the Bloodline, it started off because of Kami. We just kind of wanted to keep the group that we had, and the type of training that we do, it's not led by one coach. It's kind of led by all of us. So we're all trying to really coach each other. You know, Cub asks me for advice. I ask him for advice. He asks Dan. So it just kind of goes in a circle, and we're all kind of feeding off of each other. So it's a camp, or it's a training room where everybody's pretty high level in their craft, and we're all just lifting each other up.
Yeah, definitely, you know, from my perspective of it and seeing how you guys do it versus how other groups that I'm familiar with, I really like what you guys do in that collaborative sense that, you know, even though maybe Cub is certainly the most experienced, and, you know, quote unquote, like head coach or whatever titles, I don't feel like it's not about a title in there, that taking kind of whatever talents everyone can bring to the table is such a more effective way to do it, rather than having, you know, a guy who's just sort of like the general, just ordering his soldiers around. Because, you know, when you've been doing this now, you just turned 27.
Yeah.
So that you've been fighting MMA for 9 years, you know, you've got 9 years of experience in that, plus all the wrestling and the boxing before that. I think it's so short-sighted of a lot of more old school coaches, and a lot of times with that older coaches not seeing the experience of the athletes they work with as like valid.
Yeah. I think a lot of that too is because a lot of professional fighters and just fighters in general don't know how to make a good camp for themselves, and they don't know how to really put themselves in an environment to succeed, and they need somebody to give them orders, really, to like, hey, you need to go run, hey, you need to do this. Like, you're a professional, you already know what to do. Why do you need someone to tell you that? So it's just really a lot of fighters are afraid to think for themselves and kind of do it on their own.
Do you think that comes from growing up in sports like boxing and wrestling, that it is so like kind of old school militant a lot of times, and it's just like, you know, get yelled at, do this, do that, and fall in line?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a really old school mindset of like, hey, I've already done all this, you have to listen to me kind of thing. It's like, yeah, just because you've done it doesn't mean you even learned from it or you know what to take out of that. So I have my own mind and what I could do. I know how to approach a lot of things. And if I don't, I could ask questions, but I don't feel like the need of having somebody to coach me the whole entire time and telling me, hey, you need to do these sprints, or hey, you need to do a double this certain way. Unless your way is going to work 100%, then don't tell me that.
Yeah, and I've heard Cub talk about you having kind of a more unorthodox style in the striking and boxing side of things a bit. How do you feel like what do you see as your strengths, your greatest strengths as a fighter, and how those came to be?
I wouldn't even know. I mean, the way I fight is just, I feel like people kind of tease on me because I have a lot of, I block a lot with my hands, and I move my head a lot, but I switch stances. I block with, you know, I parry a lot, and, you know, I counter punch while I'm going forward. Usually a pressure fighter doesn't counter, but I pressure and I counter. So it's just things to me that seem, oh, if I could do it, then why wouldn't it work? You know, there's no rules in a street fight, so why wouldn't it work on MMA?
Marissa always tells me that there's no rules in a street fight when I'm trying to, like, play wrestle her, and then she, like,
she bites ball,
or, no, she, like, hits me in the nuts or something. There's, like, no rules in a street fight.
And that I was is
like,
true.
I didn't know we were having a street fight here. And I,
you're like, I would have headbutt you.
Her tiny peanut head could never withstand my giant basketball.
Juggernaut head?
Yeah. The juggernoggin,
they call that. The
juggernoggin. So you have the opportunity to train with a lot of high-level guys. You know, your own training partners, Cub, Dan Argueta, Hoffa, you know, yeah, all the bloodline guys. But also, I know you train a lot with Chito Vera. And Cub specifically mentioned to me about a sparring session with Israel Adesanya.
No. Yeah, I sparred a guy named Israel.
Israel, okay.
I can't say his last name because he's from Uzbekistan.
He said Israel. I took it as Israel Adesanya. He just said Israel. But no, he told me to ask you about this sparring session with Israel and the special aspect of it.
Oh, well, so Israel is a silver medalist in the Olympics, I believe. And he is an undefeated pro boxer that I think already has a WBC. And he's just, I think, ranked 18 in the world right now. Just a great boxer at 154s. Very Lomachenko style. But I've sparred him many times, and I do really well against him. But there was a time where I sparred him, and I had a gummy, an edible gummy, 5 milligram, and they paid me. They're like, hey, we're gonna give you $600 or $800 to do 6 rounds with Israel, and they're gonna bring a ref. And by that time, I thought I was already done. I had finished helping out Cub, and I was already halfway of being high. And right as the ref came and it was getting really real, I started freaking out even more, and I'm like, I'm too high, I can't do this. You know, I'm telling Dan, by the way, Dan is the one that gave me the edible. And, well, my eyes were red as hell, and I go in there, and I put a beating on him so bad. And, yeah, it's just, it was probably one of my better performances where I didn't feel like I even got touched while I was being high the whole time, and they were playing Cypress Hill in the background, and I was just vibing to it, and I was just like, man, I can't even get touched. This guy's the best, one of the best dudes ever. And yeah, well, I don't know if it was the edible that really made me that good, or I'm just that good and I never bring it out.
that just unlocked the more creative creative spirit in you there.
Yeah,
but sure. you'd be testing positive, right? And
not in the UFC anymore. The UFC is okay with it. Yeah. So, in the smaller regionals like LFA, they do test you for marijuana, cannabis. But the UFC is okay with it. I mean, after the Diaz brothers, I don't know even why they test it.
Yeah,
it's not an enhancer for sure.
Well,
unless it's me now.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is. They're gonna hear Dana White gonna hear this, and he's gonna be like, put it back on the ban list.
Yeah, ban list.
Yeah, we know if, you know, it's like when they say they talk about like TRT
on the Vitor,
or TRT Overeem, Uberim, and maybe it's gonna be Gummy Silva, like no one's flowing out there like Gummy Silva. So a couple of weeks ago, I did an episode that was the most difficult sport. And you have experience in several of them. So I ended up with MMA ranked as number one, wrestling ranked as number, it was tied for second, and then boxing a little bit farther down, maybe fifth or sixth.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience in those three sports, how would you rank them difficulty-wise, and in the sense of most difficult to become the most elite at it?
Yeah. I think MMA is number one. And I think boxing would be number two, and then wrestling would be number three.
So what about boxing that makes it tougher than wrestling?
Because you could be a really good grinder in wrestling, and get away with a lot of wins. In boxing, I feel like people that are really on the top, like that 5%, it's almost impossible. Like, you could never get that good. Like, they're so smooth, they're so fast, it's just a sweet science that I feel like in wrestling, the top guys are always knocking each other off. And in boxing, there's a guy always reigning supreme. And there's guys like Shakur Stevenson, Canelo, Bivol, you know, guys that are really, really good that hardly ever lose. But in wrestling, there's guys taking losses all the time, and then they get it back in a different tournament, you know? So it's hard to, I feel like boxing is a lot harder to get knocked down all the time and to beat anybody. Like, to be the top 3% or 5%, I feel like it's almost impossible.
Do you feel like, and just kind of playing devil's advocate here, I don't follow boxing very closely, but that could be an issue of, as these guys are coming up and being more and more successful in boxing, that their managers, representatives try and guide their career a bit more effectively, where, like, all right, if you're trying to be Olympic champion in wrestling, you're going to wrestle, you know, you got to go to the tournaments where you're going to wrestle the best guys, so that the wrestlers are getting maybe exposed more to their other competitors at their top level.
Yeah, of course. You know, like, they meet each other. There'll be guys that meet each other from high school, you know, and like, even when I was wrestling in high school, like, I will always go to their bracket and look for a name, and I'll be like looking at the guys that were seated, and I'll be like, all right, I already wrestled this dude, I beat this dude, you know, why is this guy seated higher than I am if I beat him in the last tournament, you know? And then stuff like that where makes my tournament a lot easier. And boxing, even the amateur tournaments, they'll fight like 4-5 times in a day, and then they have to go and cut weight again the next day and fight another 5 times. You know, it's ridiculous. Wrestling doesn't even do that. So I feel like that's why it's a little bit harder. I think the grinding, it's a lot harder with wrestling.
When you say the grinding, like the physicality
part of it? Yeah, just the training of it. And it takes so much toll on your body. I feel like the body can't withstand it for too long compared to boxing. But to be great in boxing, I think it's a lot harder than it would be to be great in wrestling.
So you came into the UFC through the Dana White Contender Series. I have heard people, I mean, while I was watching that fight that night and then looking at, you know, Reddit and Twitter and stuff after, seen people say they thought yours was the best, one of the best fights, if not the best fight in the history of Contender Series. Yep. You know, what were your emotions going into that fight, and, you know, just feelings throughout it?
I felt like it was my destiny going into that fight, and being in that fight was like, I feel like it was probably one of the better versions of myself trying to express it. But yeah, I feel like that was just, that has already been written. Like, I was supposed to do what I did to him. I was supposed to get into the UFC. The only thing that I was upset about was that if I'm able to land that many heavy shots on someone, I should be able to put them out. That was really the only thing I was upset about. But really was because Cub was telling me, he's like, man, you need to be able to put guys out if you hit them. What was it? What was the record? 200? Or between the both of us, it was like 400 significant strikes, and it was just,
I mean, you did almost punch the man's ear off.
Well, yeah.
I'd never seen, you know, outside of a Mike Tyson biting
hanging situation. Off.
Yeah. Like, it was like cut like right on the where it attaches back here, right?
Yeah, the little
crevice. It seemed like it was about to fall off.
I mean, I saw him in the hospital, and they brought him in the stretcher, and he had a neck brace, and they had his ear taped, and I looked at him and I'm like, oh man, you look effed up, bro. Like, you look like you got in a car crash kind of deal. And then he told me, he's all like, man, I told my coach that he doesn't even hit hard. And then my coach looked at me and said, dude, you got dropped like within the first 14 seconds of the fight, you got dropped. And he's all like, I don't even remember that.
So for MMA fans, UFC fans, to understand, like, what is the process? And of course, it's a little bit different for everyone, but like, how does someone get to the UFC? I know they don't just go to the UFC gym and start training UFC and get a black belt in UFC. Those aren't real things, by the way. You can't train UFC, it's MMA. But, you know, what is a, I guess, more common than not sort of process for people to make it to the UFC through amateur or everything?
I feel like you just need to have a good solid base, but you need to expose yourself in a lot of amateur fights and try to get that experience through there as much as you can. I had almost like 7 amateur fights in a year, and then I decided to go pro. And it's, I know guys that have been amateur for 5 or 6 years, or maybe the whole entire time that I've been pro. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, you're maybe just too afraid to go pro now at that point. But to get to the UFC, I think you have to just expose yourself and then really throw yourself into the fire. And if you lose your the most known record, 0-1, I think that's a good blessing, honestly. I think it teaches you a lot how to get better and what you're really lacking in. And that's why I love MMA. It's just, it really humbles you and it shows you what you really suck at.
So what, your first pro fight, what promotion was that in?
My first pro fight? Mm-hmm. CFFC, which was in UFC Fight Pass.
What was the purse of that?
I got paid like $400.
$400 a show, $400 to win, only win.
No, I think it was $200 a show and $200 to win.
$200 a show, $200 to win.
Yeah.
And then what was next after that?
Like the pay or
the promotion?
The next promotion, I fought in Fight Club OC, in hometown.
And then to LFA?
And then to Combate, which okay. is a Mexican promotion. And then I went back to Fight Club OC, I had 2 more there, and then it was LFA.
And a lot of those early ones, I mean, it's just kind of, you get in where you fit in, like if...
But you have to be able to beat the regional guys around you.
Uh-huh.
You have to be able to compete with all the guys that are coming out. And then you really put yourself like against everybody SoCal or everybody like in your area. Like for LFA, it's more across the United States, but those are the guys that are like the next best thing before the UFC. So once you start competing in LFA, you really have to start showing all your marbles. So Sean Shelby could really like you and be like, yeah, we want that guy. But it takes a long time for some people just to get to LFA.
Mm-hmm. So. The as you prepared for your first UFC fight, so you're 1-0 in the UFC now as of a couple weeks ago. So you're preparing for that first UFC fight. What did you feel like was the biggest challenge preparing for that?
Well, I wanted to keep wrestling during my camp because I felt like that's where I was going to be really dominant against Josh Koulibaly. But I didn't tear a ligament in my finger, but my finger got really beat up and I wasn't able to do anything as far as wrestling. So I had a whole camp without wrestling.
And it's still shut.
Yeah.
It's big. It's a girthy knuckle.
But yeah, I stick with jiu-jitsu and I kept trying to grapple as much as I can without really damaging it. So it was just really hard for me to, I couldn't even train with poofies or the MMA sparring gloves. So I kept training with boxing gloves, kept doing my sparring rounds with Cheeto with boxing gloves. So it was really difficult to be 100% and really try to crack with my left hand just because of my finger. I couldn't really close it. So
from the mental side of things, when you became a UFC fighter, did you feel like the expectations of that made training harder, or made the mental preparation of the fight harder?
Yeah, it did. A lot of people kept telling me this, and which it was only scaring me, but I wasn't trying to show it. Was like, hey, you know, now the hard part is trying to stay in the UFC. And I was more like, man, that's, you're right. A lot of people get cut after two straight losses, or, you know, three losses in a row. So I didn't want to start my UFC career, you know, 0-1.
Mm-hmm. Do you think with between the missing weight, and then as you're standing there waiting for them to announce that third score,
mm-hmm.
did it cross your mind like if I lose and I missed weight, this might be it?
No, it's just it's a bad look. You know, it's just a bad look with the UFC and them really wanting to do a favor for you later on, you mm-hmm. know. They're not gonna, be like, man, he's not even a professional. He missed weight and he lost. Like, how can we help him out if he hasn't done anything other than the contender series to show his worth? And I know that with the UFC, you really have to show your worth and why you belong there. So, yeah, I was stressing out a lot.
Yeah. Because I felt, you know, coming out of the contender series that you had such a strong showing there. Yeah, you know, and just an exciting fight, and ultimately that's what the UFC is in the yeah. business of, is exciting, you know, is fight entertainment.
Yeah, yeah.
That there was, you know, some buzz for you among the UFC, and they're putting you on, you know, doing that, some extra interviews and that kind of
stuff
with you. That I could feel that weighing on you some in the training.
Yeah,
you know, of like, man,
I just want to fight. Yeah. I don't want to do all the media stuff. I don't want the attention. It's been something that I've been struggling with, and I've been talking with Cove multiple times about it for a while, and he's always kept me level, where he's like, hey, just take it as it is. You know, it's your job now, and it's something that it's been hard for me to really accept, because, you know, I see myself as a fighter. I don't see myself as I'm here to entertain the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to fight the best. I'm not here to entertain everybody. I'm here just to beat this dude and give me my money, kind of thing. So yeah, it's been something hard for me to really get by with.
I mean, the bright lights and pressure of this show is overwhelming you right now?
yeah, my hands are sweaty and clammy.
So. So growing up, you weren't really an MMA or UFC fan, or were you?
I wasn't. The only guy I knew really was like Cain Velasquez, and that's just because he was Mexican.
Yeah.
And he has brown pride on his chest.
So more a boxing fan then.
Oh yeah, I could name almost every boxer even right now. I still even follow it, not as much. But even with UFC, I only keep my eye on a few people, and I feel like boxing, it's just something that I have a love for, since because I grew up with it as a kid.
So like, you know, 12-year-old Danny Silva, he's at his boxing gym in Santa Ana. And I'm sure like the same way that basketball players growing up, they're thinking, all right, I'm Kobe Bryant and I'm making this shot. And you're going in, you know, to hit mitts or hit the bag or spar when you're a kid. What boxer was like you imagining yourself to be, or that you really looked up to?
I looked up to a lot of boxers. You know, I wouldn't say I would want to be like Oscar De La Hoya, but he was a guy that I looked up to, especially when he fought like Fernando Vargas But the guy that I really enjoyed watching was Marco Antonio Barrera when he fought Morales. And that was just like they had a trilogy. It was just such a great fight. Two Mexican fighters, really good technicians, but also good brawlers, and they're brawling while being technical at the same time. It was just like, it was really like watching something so amazing at the same time. And they fought three times, and I was always had that like, man, I want to be in a war like that where I fight this dude three times because it's so close all the time. So I've always pictured myself being in fights like that as a kid.
When a couple, maybe two, three months ago, you guys did a drill in your training where you got assigned style.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was for fans of The Office. It was like sort of like the Diversity Day episode of The Office where they had the cards. And, you know, Michael's doing the, do you want to try my googie googie? But instead of, you know, Jewish and Indian, and yeah. I think Michael and that was Martin Luther King Jr. You guys were
karate.
Yeah, karate.
Boxer.
And
Muay Thai.
Mexican boxing, right?
Was yeah, and it was styles. Mexican boxing. It wasn't like Floyd Mayweather boxing.
Yeah, so what, like, specifically that style, what is Mexican boxing?
Well, the stereotype is chin down, pressure forward all the time, and, you know, just overwhelm with volume your opponent, and he's going to eventually break. I don't feel like that's technically the stereotype completely true, but that's how people approach it for Mexican boxing. But I think, like, Chavez, Julio Cesar Chavez, was a pressure forward boxer, but he was able to slip going forward. And I think that's extremely hard if you're able to slip going forward. I think going backwards and being able to dodge and slip, it's a lot easier.
And is that just like from a timing and space standpoint that you've got that extra couple of inches to
going backwards?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just because you're evading already. So if they're having to overreach, it's easier for you to see it coming and just get out of the way. But when you're going head on into a punch and then last second you just slip it, now the punch is way beyond you, and now you just have him really exposed, and now you could really hurt him. So being able to do that going forward, I think it's way more effective, and Chavez was really great at doing it, and he folded a lot of guys like that. So I try to mimic it as much as I could. I switch a lot of stances, so I feel like it has benefited me tremendously.
If there's one boxer in history that you wish you could see them switch, you know, convert to MMA, who would it be?
Ooh. I mean,
and I'm not talking an Art Jimmerson style switch here, you know, UFC one with one boxing glove.
Or on James Toney.
Yeah. But a guy who, like, is a high level boxer and then begins, you know, the same way that guys have won medals, Olympic medals in wrestling, and then they switch to MMA.
Yeah.
But a boxer who's at that kind of level and makes a transition.
I think Terrence Crawford, just because he's a switch hitter and he grew up wrestling. And he's, I think, up there with Canelo. So I see him as maybe number one and then Canelo two. But Terrence Crawford, I believe that if he decided to be an MMA fighter, he would probably do the best out of all the elite boxers. Just, he's so good.
So when UFC was created, UFC 1, Art Davies and Horian Gracie, mm-hmm. you know, got it going. And I listened to this podcast series about it, really interesting one. And Art Davies talked about how it kind of came, you know, from sort of the bar argument of, like, you know, who do you think would win in a fight, you know, at the time, like, he's talking about, like, you think Muhammad Ali or Bruce Lee gonna win in a fight kind of thing, or
yeah.
And so I think UFC 1 was 1993. I could see a world, an alternate universe, where they get 1993 Mike Tyson because he's coming out of jail right then. And if they would have had a shitload of money, because obviously he was making a ton of money to box back then. But that would have been just crazy if they could have got Mike Tyson to go into UFC 1.
Okay.
He does UFC 1. Mike Tyson versus Hoist Gracie in the championship there?
If it's... Hoist should win.
Yeah.
Just because Tyson is not a grappler. But in a street fight, I don't know.
I mean, UFC 1 was about as close to a street fight as it could get. So
I think Mike Tyson would headbutt him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he would probably take out his teeth or something. You know, he would bite him. If he headbutts Hoist, he's knocking off his teeth.
Yeah. I think the rules were only like no biting, no eye gouging.
There was headbutts, though.
Headbutts, yes, but no biting. Yeah. I think it was biting and eye gouging and maybe intentional groin shots. Those might have been allowed, though. I'm not totally sure on that.
Hits to the back of the head were allowed, I think.
Definitely were. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I'd say if anything, it was just biting, eye gouging, and groin shots, I think, were the only things that.
Yeah. I think that's a hard one.
That would be.
Because all it takes for Tyson, literally all it takes is not, it takes just one lucky punch for him to land it. Any of his punches that land, I think that's all it will take.
Yeah. What a wild alternate universe that would
be crazy.
That would be. If Mike Tyson was in UFC 1, I don't know if we trained at a Gracie Baja these days, people would have been like, that stuff doesn't work.
Oh, that's the guy that got knocked out.
Yeah.
No, I see that. I mean, even with like my family tells me, you think you would be Bruce Lee? And I'm like, yes. I'm like, I love all the Bruce Lee stuff. I think it influenced like MMA, obviously. I think it just because he was super creative with he created his own style, literally. But yeah, if he came into any MMA school, he would get pieced up.
Well, I think people who have been fans of MMA for a long time, and nostalgia is such a powerful thing for people. You see it, you know, in the NBA talking about the guys from the 90s were better, and you know, these football players, everyone's soft now, and it's like, and you look at MMA, and you know, it's existed since 1993 for 31 years.
Yeah.
Like, if you think of that as just a person, like, how much better is, you know, any athlete after they've been doing the sport for, you know, 30 years compared to 20 years compared to 10 years. Yeah. And like the level, and I'll say it for you, you didn't have to say it, but like, a top 10 145 guy or a top 5 145 guy from even 2014, let alone 2004, tries to come to UFC now, like, you're smashing him. Like, it's, you're coming in so much more with one UFC fight, so much more well-rounded in a skill set than people, even 5 years ago. Like, it's such a steep curve still.
Yeah. I think that's why they were saying that the Contender Series fights were UFC level fights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just to show it's not even technically you're not a UFC fighter, but that's a UFC level fight, you know, and they're not even in the UFC. So these are guys that are barely breaking and peaking, apparently. And they're at the point where they're supposed to be really turning that corner, but they're not in their prime yet, you know, and I think that's just to show how much the sport has evolved. Like, it's been tremendously.
Yeah, and that development and evolution and turnover is so like rapid now. You see it with how often the championships turn over, and how a guy goes from, you know, like a Tyron Woodley, someone like that, who in kind of the span of 1 year goes from dominating a division to like multiple losses in a row. And, yeah. and maybe it's, you know, a guy gets knocked out once and it's a psychological thing, or, you know, the chin becomes kind of softer with time or whatever. But yeah, you know, I'm not trying to pick on Tyron Woodley here, but like it's happened in a lot yeah. of weight classes where the guy who's at the top or right there for a long time, and then he loses and he loses again and again and again.
Yeah.
And it's just like, man, it's if you're not constantly developing the skills and evolving and improving, like the game just passing guys by really fast.
Yeah, that's why I listen to Cub, because he's been in the game for so long and just maintaining himself in the UFC, it's also another hard thing to do, you know. And he's not trying to go for a title run. He just wants to fight the best exciting fights that he could kind of get, you know. And I know that's what I know that's why I give him a lot of respect, because it's just so hard just to even maintain himself there. And I'm not trying to bash on his age, but he's 40 years old, you know, and that's crazy. There's guys that are super young or in their prime and they can't even get into the UFC.
Yeah. And for a dude that's been fighting professional MMA for, I think, 20 years this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's remarkably healthy.
Mm-hmm.
In both his body and mind.
Yeah.
You know, if someone comes to me and they're like, I've been a UFC fighter for 20 years. If they're mush mouth slurring their words and stuff, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
You know, as sad as that is, and guys who stay fighting too long, but Cub is obviously very, very bright and
very smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
City of Santa Ana. What does that mean to you to represent on the global stage?
It's just it sounds bad, but it's like the poor city in Orange County, which doesn't really say a lot because it's Orange County. But I feel like representing Santa Ana, to me, it's representing everybody that I grew up with and everybody that I felt like we all struggled together. So to me, being able to really, I don't even want to say I carry it on my back because I don't, but just showing that I'm from a place where everybody's kind of prideful, it's already like a lot of pride for me, where I'm happy to be representing Santa Ana.
Yeah, you know, I do the work at the school in Santa Ana, and we got one kid in the class who does boxing, and you know, our class is an island of misfits, but some of them I don't think had any idea what the UFC was. But when I told them, you know, the night before, or 2 days before your fight, you know, we had a class on Thursday and you were fighting Saturday. And I told him, I was like, hey guys, like if you can watch ESPN on Saturday, like a guy that I coach, he's from Santa Ana, he's fighting in the UFC. And, you know, with the kids who like got what that meant,
yeah,
you could see that like even pride for them to be like,
yeah,
someone they didn't know, but they're like, oh, he's from Santa Ana. Like,
yeah,
bet that's our guy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I know maybe like a few people that fight from out of Santa Ana, maybe not at the highest level, but there's a boxer that does represent Santa Ana. He's fighting in a high level under Oscar De La Hoya from Golden Boy. And, you know, every time they bring him up, to me, like, it gives me pride just watching him represent Santa Ana. So, like, I mean, I can't imagine little kids, you know, seeing like, man, this guy from Santa Ana is fighting. It's just, it motivates you to want to do that one day and be able to be like, hey, I'm from here and I represent here. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, you and I grew up probably mileage wise, like,
yeah, it's that far.
6 or 7 miles apart from each other.
Yeah. City over.
Yeah. Like in Irvine and Santa Ana. And I don't think that people from Irvine probably don't have the same level of pride and like, you know, I mean, I do get pumped. Like, I went to the same high school as Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah, I was about to say.
and Will Ferrell, you know, but a different, you know, I think sense of community and you know, probably for lack of a better term, like an underdog mentality a lot of times for guys to feel like, man, I'm making, like, we have a lot of kids in our class who, you know, they might be the first one in their family who's going to graduate high school or to go to college and that kind of stuff. And feeling like, man, I'm lifting up my family, my city, and what you do is something to be very proud of.
Yeah. I just think we need more I wouldn't say guys like me, but more people trying to just lift the city up, you know, and it just brings more pride to the city and to the people living there. It's just, I feel like it will make more of the city of Santa Ana happy. It's not really a happy place.
Yeah. One year from now, where do you see yourself?
Sitting right here doing another podcast.
Another podcast? Maybe be about, what, 3-0, maybe 4-0 in the UFC at that point, a year from now? Busy year?
Yeah, I think I would be probably close to 4-0. Just because Cub wants me to fight two more times this year.
Yeah, well, I mean, you were trying to take like a month off of everything. Like,
it wasn't my fault. But yeah, I'm definitely one of the guys that I like resting after my fights because I normally don't come out too clean. But yeah, I've been trying to turn that around. But a year from now, I want to be fighting top 15 guy, if not sooner, just because Josh Koulibaly was ranked 30 in the world. And before I even fought him, they had me ranked 150, and now they have me ranked 50 in the world. So I know what I'm capable of, and I know that I could beat the top 15 guys. I wouldn't say I could beat the top 5 guys, but top 15, I know I can.
I was surprised, especially coming off your contender series and seeing like, all right, UFC seems to like you and be excited about you. I was surprised to see a fight that you were the underdog in to be your first.
Yeah.
Your first fight, but
I think it was a really good move on their part. Like, it's a win-win situation. I lose, they don't get to pay me that much or anywhere near as Josh Koulibaly would get paid. But if I win and I rise to the occasion, now they might have a potential star. And I feel like that's what they were really trying to really test me. Like, hey, can this kid really rise to this occasion? And I feel like I did, you know, besides missing weight.
Yeah, we gotta take care of that.
That's your fault. You got me big, man.
Don't be trying to blame that. Hey, I did exactly what you asked. You are looking bigger though. 5 years from now.
Ooh.
32 years old. I mean, that's right, kinda
prime.
Yeah. That early 30s really probably prime for MMA fighters.
What I would expect myself to either be champion or to be in the top three, like, and be consistent in the top three, like a Holloway. Like, I will hold the line and not let anybody pass to fight for the title. Like, I would rather do that. All right, that's where I picture myself being, top three or being champion.
20 years from now.
I'm retired.
Oh, well, yeah. I hope you're retired from MMA, but yeah. But do you think about that ever, like, you know, legacy or what? You have the perfect career in the UFC, and then you've been retired for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
What you'd be doing after that?
I've never been much of a coacher. I feel like if I retired, I wouldn't want to go into coaching. Honestly, I really haven't put a lot of thought into 20 years from now. I guess I just kind of picture myself enjoying my life, and that's all I really think about, is just enjoying my life. Just, yeah, I'm not thinking about really maintaining myself in the game after I let it go. Everybody's different though.
Yeah.
It might change. I don't know.
Cool. Danny, thank you very much, buddy. Okay. I'll see you in the garage tomorrow.
Yeah.